Bloom was one of America's first oral surgeons, a prestigious specialist who had pioneered the use of X-rays for dental diagnosis. His fees were extortionate, but Theo insisted that they visit him anyway. He could borrow money on their furniture to pay the bills, he reasoned. It eased Hazel's pain. If Dr. Bloom could stop this endless decay in her mouth, then it would all be worth it. As a mechanic, Theo Kuza was not wealthy, and nor was his family. His father, also called Theo, was a postman. Theo Sr. had saved up money to buy a house for his old age, but he now offered some of his savings to his son for Hazel's treatment. He took it gratefully, and the appointment was duly attended. Bloom was a balding man, with a neatly trimmed moustache, spectacles, and a high forehead. As he introduced himself to Hazel and began his examination, he quickly realized that he had never seen a condition like hers before. Her face was swollen with pus bags, but it was the condition of her jawbone that was most perplexing. It seemed almost moth-eaten. It literally had holes in it. But what, Dr. Bloom now pondered, could have caused it? Bloom was worth his money. Later, he would try to find out the exact chemicals in the luminous paint, although to no avail. For now, he took a medical and employment history from Hazel and made a provisional diagnosis. She was suffering from poisoning by a radioactive substance. He admitted her to the Flower Hospital in New York to operate on her jaw. It would be the first, but not the last, of such procedures Hazel had to endure. Yet although Bloom had offered a diagnosis and swift and specialist treatment, he didn't offer the one thing that Theo had been yearning for. Hope. That was all he really wanted, to know that there was light at the end of the tunnel, that they could get through this and come out the other side into a shining day, and another one, and another day after that. Instead, Bloom told him, there is little chance of recovery. All the money in the world couldn't save his wife now. The Radium Girl's agony hadn't gone unnoticed in the community. That same month, a civic-minded resident wrote to the Department of Labour to raise concerns about the orange plant. This time, it was John Roach's boss, Commissioner Andrew McBride, who stepped in, grilling Health Officer Lenore Young on what she'd found out the previous summer. She apologised for seeming negligent, interviewed the affected girls, and then recommended that the Public Health Service be called in. Yet McBride felt there was not sufficient evidence to warrant doing so. His reasoning may have been political, for the Department of Labour was pro-business. Under state law, it had no authority to stop an industrial process, even if it was harmful. As a result of these factors, the department now gave the plant a clean bill of health and completely stopped looking into the dial painter's illnesses. They took this decision even though more and more women were suffering the same symptoms. It was a stalemate. No diagnosis, no clue as to the cause. No one lifting a finger to find out what was really going on in that radium studio in Orange. But then the stalemate was ended by an unexpected source. The United States Radium Corporation itself. As more and more girls fell ill, the company found that, in a stark contrast to the glory days in the war, they were encountering considerable difficulty recruiting staff. A number of the girls had quit and no one wanted to replace them. Production was now being held up.